Want access to search and listen to the entire webmasterradio.fm archive of over 1,500 podcasts commercial-free? Just become a webmasterradio.fm elite member for less than 99 cents a day. Otherwise, the last 60 days of content are on the house. Webmasterradio.fm, we're everywhere.
A rose by any other name would still be the same.
Move over, Shakespeare.
You need to differentiate yourself from your competition. Do it by aligning yourself with a company who has earned the trust of Jupiter Media, the NHL, and Lionsgate Films, among others. Moniker.com is the most secure ICANN-accredited register on the planet, offering you domain registration, hosting, domain sales, and acquisition services. Wrap that up with 24/7 support. That's your winning combination. Moniker.com. More than a name.
Feeling better? Looking better. Making life better. It's Life Tips. We'll explore the latest innovations, introduce you to the latest products, and bring you the tips from experts and environmental pioneers to help you lead a better life. Life Tips. Making your life smarter, better, faster, wiser. Welcome your hosts, Byron White and Amanda Smith.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I've been out for a little while. Amanda, how are you?
I'm good. What's going on? It's almost Christmas, Byron.
Happy, happy, ho, ho,
yay,
ho. Are those fireworks, or did Santa get stuck in a chimney there?
I think it's a round of applause at the holiday spirit.
Ah, that's fun. That's fun. Leave it to George. There we are again. Yes, we're live in the studio. There are 100 peoples all around us here. So.
As usual, you know.
We had a birthday for one of our colleagues today.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Curley, one of our favorite sales reps. Happy birthday to Sean over the air, everyone.
Now, Byron, we have a really cool guest on today, and we're going to be talking about maybe something a little less holiday-related, but still interesting and still a hot topic. We're going to be talking about the impending bailout for the auto industry and, you know, what it means to us, what it means to consumers, what it's going to mean for the economy. So we have an expert on from Autoblog today who's going to be telling us all about it.
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to that. Do you have a quick take on the bailout yourself right now so we can find any flaws in your logic as we continue through the show here?
Should we write the check and bail them out? These big fat executives who are just, you know, hemorrhaging money. But, you know, I was in Florida a couple weeks ago for Thanksgiving, and I actually met a guy who is on a pension plan from Ford. And he was like, you know, you forget about all these people who are here on pension and really need those pensions. It's not fair to punish those people. So I'm sort of caught at a crossroads here.
Mm. And how do you think it ties in with the commitment for the green movement, if you will? Do you think it's a good opportunity to sort of, you know, put the nail in the chunk of wood that says, hey, we need a commitment, 100% hybrid in 3 years, or we're not going to write a check and give you any money?
Absolutely. It's just like our show last week. It ties in perfectly. This is a golden opportunity. They should start making some serious environmental demands of these car companies and say, you know, do this or no money for you.
So back in just a few minutes, everyone, with our guest today, Sam Alvesamed. Did I pronounce that right? I don't know. We'll find out when we're back from the break. We'll be back in just a minute, everyone.
Life Tips will be right back after this short break.
Friend Finder, the world's largest online dating network,
featuring over 100 million profiles
at hot sites such as Passion.com and FastCupid.com, represents enormous profit-making opportunities for webmasters
just like you.
With Friend Finder's ability to geo-target and provide billing solutions in most languages and currencies, you are sure to find our comprehensive network to be a good friend
to your wallet. Get more traffic-maximizing details now at friendfinder.com.
How do you choose the right affiliate network to partner with? The answer is simple. MarketHealth.com, where health and wealth connect. Established in 1998 and formerly known as Joe Bucks, the MarketHealth.com affiliate network allows you to market and promote the world's leading health and beauty offers on the net. Start making recurring income and the highest payouts in our industry. Choose from over 50 of the hottest selling offers ranging from herbal supplements, skincare, vitamins, beauty products, weight loss, and much more. Sign up for free at MarketHealth.com and start making money today.
And now back to Life Tips. Making your life smarter, better, faster, and wiser. Here are your hosts.
Welcome back, everyone, with our guest today, Sam Abdelsamad. Sam, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing today?
How'd I do on the pronunciation?
That was just fine.
Yeah.
You're lucky me. It's not my birthday. You're the technical editor for several green websites, including Green Fuels Forecast, Diesel Forecast, Hydrogen Forecast, a lot of forecasting going on. Tell us a little bit about some of your sites, what your role and goal is, and then before we ask you the tough questions about your take on the whole automobile industry bailout.
Well, the three forecast sites, Green Fuels, Diesel, and Hydrogen Forecast, are all focused on various alternative fuels areas, looking at the fuels, the technology, the vehicles that are using those types of fuels. We write about those and talk about what's going on in those areas. And then I also write for Autoblog and Autoblog Green, which are, Autoblog's more of a general interest automotive news site, and Autoblog Green, obviously, again, is more focused on alternative fuel vehicles.
Got it. And what's your quick forecast in all of your research and diagnostic? What's the state of the union with some of these niches that you're focusing on with regards to alternative energy?
Well, there's definitely a lot of progress being made on the technology. A lot of progress being made on batteries, fuel cells, advanced next generation biofuels. Clean diesel engines, all those things are making huge advances. The problem that, everything is facing right now, though, is the general economic situation we've got, because every single one of those technologies adds a lot of cost to a vehicle. And right now, especially over the last 3 months since Wall Street basically took a dump, nobody's buying anything, even conventional vehicles. Even sales, in November, last month, sales of the Toyota Prius dropped by 50% compared to last year because nobody is buying anything. And it's not just Detroit, it's everybody is suffering right now.
Well, is there any, so it's going to be tough to find any good news here, but let's just take a quick survey, if you could, about the current structure of the automobile industry. Its dependence on the union and labor and the battles that have gone on and what, in my mind, is an archaic system of, you have to pay me this because the union says you have to, and if you don't, we'll all go on strike. And just the profiteering going on both from the union's perspective as well as corporate management's perspective. Isn't it time to rethink the whole automobile industry? Much like microbreweries are making us rethink the beer industry, which I think is a pretty good analogy here, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, well, I think, to some degree, it's a little bit unfair to just blame unions and management for all of this, because the reality of the situation, if you get past, some of the headline numbers, like the $70-plus dollars an hour that the Detroit automakers pay out to workers, or supposedly pay out, and look at what they're actually getting paid in terms of wages and benefits. The difference between what Detroit the people working for GM, Ford, and Chrysler make compared to what workers working for Toyota, Honda, and Nissan in the United States make is actually only a few dollars. Where the big difference comes in is in terms of legacy costs. All the manufacturers, the unions, over the course of the last half century, they negotiated things like pension plans, health care for retirees. So, once people retire after working 30, 35, 40 years in the factory, You know, they get health care from the manufacturer. They get a pension, it gets paid into while they were working. The problem is when all that stuff was negotiated, 40, 50 years ago, most of these guys, they would retire at 65, and more often than not, they didn't live more than 2, 3, 4 years beyond that anyway. The problem is over the last, several decades, people have been living longer, and all of a sudden, the cost of providing health care for these people has skyrocketed because, you've got, the cost of health care skyrocketed for everybody, but also, the fact that they've got to do it for many, many more years now. And that difference, that $70 an hour, almost $30 of that, is just to pay for retiree benefits, the health care, the pensions, and so on, that the Japanese manufacturers, who've only been doing business here in the States for 15, 20 years, who have relatively few retirees, they haven't had to deal with those issues yet. Although, if you look at their numbers over the last 10 years, as they've started to get some retirees, those numbers are starting to climb, and eventually they're going to be hit by the same problem. And that's an area that really needs to be attacked that nobody in Congress wants to talk about.
Is there... what's your prediction in your mind right now, based upon all the data I'm sure you're studying pretty closely, and your comrades are as well? Do you think we're going to see a bailout? Do you think there's going to be any interesting restrictions on it? Do you think a bailout is a good thing? I mean, what's your take on it?
I think something needs to be done because if you look at what the manufacturers have been doing over the last 2, 3 years. They have made huge strides in terms of changing their product lineup. But the other thing that most people who don't work in the auto industry don't realize is the lead times involved in this industry. You don't whip out a new car in 6 months or a year. It takes 3, 4 years to develop a new car from scratch. And so what's happened is starting about 2005, 2006, 2007. The car makers saw where fuel prices were going. And they started making their future product plans based on gas prices of $3, $4, $5 a gallon. And so if you look at their product plans for what's coming out in the 2010, 2011 time frame, they're all much smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. And but the problem is it takes time to get there. And so they've been working on those vehicles. They're coming, and there's going to be this huge, there's supposed to be this huge flurry of vehicles coming, really starting around the end of 2009. The problem is they suddenly hit this huge pothole with economic collapse on Wall Street, and all of a sudden, the combination of gas prices going to $4 a gallon last summer and then the economic collapse means that everybody lost confidence. Nobody's buying any cars. If we hadn't had this issue over the last 3 months with Wall Street and people were still buying cars, then the car makers would have enough cash flow to get them through to the end of next year so they could get these new products on the market. But now they don't. Their sales have dropped over the last year from an annual rate of nearly 17 million units, down to they're now predicting it's going to be about a little less than 13 for 2008. Mm-hmm. It may be as low as 9.5 million in 2009, unless the economy really picks up, and everybody is getting hammered by that. And so something needs to be done in a number of ways. I think the car makers need some financing to get them through the next year, but also need to do something about the general economy in order to get people buying cars again. And buying everything, really, not just cars, but everything is in trouble right now, every business in this country.
So why are we so far behind our Japanese counterparts with regard to advances in technology, advances in fuel efficiency? I mean, they're making smaller, better cars than we are. We're still creating these giant gas
chuggers. I don't think we are that far behind. I mean, if you look at most of the, if you look at, at the smaller end of the market, cars like the Ford Focus and the Chevy Cobalt, those cars are just as fuel efficient, if not more so, than competitors like the Honda Civic and Toyota Corolla. So they're not. The problem the problem has been the U.S. market. U.S. consumers for the last decade have had this fascination with big trucks and SUVs, And all those, you know, those fuel-efficient cars like the Cobalt and the Focus have been on the market for the last decade, but Americans haven't been buying them. They've been buying big, expensive trucks, or big fuel-thirsty trucks. Mm-hmm. You know, and the reason for that is because gas was cheap. And unless fuel prices stay high, you know, people didn't start buying Focuses and Cobalts this year until gas went to $3.50, $4 a gallon. Mm-hmm. As soon as that happened, people jumped into small cars. But then, you know, a few months later, you had this economic collapse, and they stopped buying everything. You know, so this whole thing about, you know, the Japanese being so far ahead, I really don't think is a valid point. You know, and over the last couple of years, the last few years especially, you know, Toyota, for example, and Nissan have jumped, or tried to jump, whole hog into the full-size truck market to compete with the Detroit automakers. And what's happened there is they didn't have as good a product as Detroit, and they weren't able to sell. The only reason that their average, their fuel economy average was higher was because they weren't able to actually compete in those big truck markets and sell those vehicles that were competitive. You know, if you look at, you know, segment by segment, the Detroit automakers are fully competitive with the Japanese automakers.
Mm-hmm. Sam, what do you think the success would be with, or what do you think the existing success is with what I would call sort of this micro brew, this micro car manufacturing industry in the United States?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking there. I mean, do you think that, are you saying, you know, would small car, like smaller car manufacturers, be able to succeed?
Yeah. And begin, you know, developing
interest. That's a really hard thing to do because, you know, one of the issues we've got in this country is the auto industry is the most heavily regulated industry in the world. Nothing is more regulated than the car business. And it costs a tremendous amount of money to develop a car and go through all the certification processes required to actually put it on the road in this country. You know, between safety regulations, emissions regulations, everything else, it's hugely expensive. I mean, look at Tesla Motors as an example. Okay, these guys started in 2003, and, you know, they've spent somewhere probably close to $200 million already. Somewhere between $150 and $200 million to get their first 100 cars on the road. And, you know, that's an electric car for the Tesla Roadster. So they didn't have to deal with emissions certification because there are no emissions. But they had to go through all the safety regulations. And even that, they were able to short-circuit some of that because their car is based on, in part, on the architecture of an existing car, the Lotus Elise. You know, so... You know, they didn't have to design completely from scratch for that car. You know, starting a car company from scratch is an enormously difficult proposition, and I really don't think it's a practical one. For, you know, it's hard to start a car company. It's not like you know, getting some vats and, you know, starting to brew some beer. That's a totally different ball of wax. It's not even a valid comparison, I don't think.
Byron, maybe we should start a car company.
I don't think Sam would write any articles about our company. He doesn't.
No, that's not true at all. I mean, I write articles about startups all the time. In fact, I'm working on right now. But, you know, it also got to keep in mind that, you know, it's, like I say, it's, I mean, I worked in the industry before I started writing. I worked as an engineer for 17 years. And, you know, so I know what's involved. And, you know, I mean, I've watched these startups, you know, try to get going and struggle. I mean, companies like Phoenix Motors in California, mm-hmm. with their electric truck, mm-hmm. Tesla, Zap, you know, and many others. You know, far more often than not, you know, they don't succeed because, like I said, it's an enormously capital intensive business, and there's a lot of regulations that everybody has to deal with. Now, you know, if people are willing to set aside some of those regulations, I mean, one of the ways that some of these startups have tried to get around it, some of the electric vehicle startups, is by building three-wheeled vehicles, because three-wheelers are classed as motorcycles, and so they're not subject to the same crash standards as cars. And, you know, that's fine as long as you're aware of it. But, you know, the problem is, you know, you put a body, just because you put a body on this thing, people look at it and think, oh, it must be a car, so it must be as safe as that Honda Civic or that Ford Focus, and it's not. You know, I mean, you crash that thing into a wall, and you're going to have a big problem. Whereas, you know, in a Focus or a Civic, it's a completely different story.
Mm-hmm. So, as we begin to wrap up the show here today, this is a complicated issue. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, optimism? Anything positive that you see coming out of the current discussions going on that would lead us to believe that, you know, the whole economy isn't going to be dragged down by the automobile industry? And what is the correlation you see there as well?
Well, you know, I think if we let the auto industry go down, you know, if you let the Detroit industry go down, it's going to drag down, you know, the foreign automakers with it as well. It's going to drag down a lot of other industries because, you know, the thing you have to remember is, you know, for every employee working directly for an automaker, there's another four or five people working for suppliers to those companies. And then on top of that, you've got all the small businesses in the areas of these factories that are dependent on the revenues that they get from people who work in those factories, you know, at restaurants and stores and whatever. So, you know, there's a big cascading effect. You know, one of the things that I think definitely needs to be done if we really want to make a dent in fuel consumption is we have to stop pushing for lower fuel prices. Fuel prices need to be higher. You know, when the time when we actually started to make a dent in fuel consumption in this country was when gas went to $3, $4 a gallon. And I think it needs to be at least at those levels. The problem is politicians in this country are totally unwilling to even consider a fuel tax that would set a minimum level for gas prices or fuel prices. You know, fuel prices, I personally believe, need to be taxed up to a minimum level so that, you know, when you have a situation like right now where the price of oil has dropped down into the $35 barrel range and gas is right now around here, you know, it's about $1.60 a gallon, you know, we had a perfect opportunity this summer when gas was at $4 a gallon to set a floor level, and when the price drops below that, you know, just tax it up to that level and maintain it there. Because at that level, then people stay out of the trucks, they buy more efficient vehicles, and I think that's, you know, that's what needs to be done. Then you do that, that drives the demand for hybrids and smaller, more efficient vehicles and electric vehicles. You've got to keep that fuel price up. It's as simple as that. Because just mandating building those vehicles won't help you unless there's a demand for those vehicles. And, you know, I mean, right now we've got a situation where even if there was a demand for those vehicles, people can't afford them. They can't get loans. So, you know, you've got to address the overall economic situation.
By implementing a tax on gasoline to potentially help fund the bailout, wouldn't that begin to put pressure on the major automobile manufacturers to create, develop hybrids and all work as a team to use less fuel?
Yeah, I mean, they're already doing that. They're developing those vehicles. You know, but the problem is there needs to be a demand for those vehicles from the consumer side as well. And, you know, the tax, you know, I see the revenues from those taxes being used in two ways. One, you know, in part, you know, for a bailout, but also, you know, to maybe reduce taxes on lower and middle income people, you know, give them some money back in their pocket so they can afford to go out and buy a car. Because right now, they can't afford to do that. You know, those cars are going to be more expensive. There's no way around that. You know, you add an electric motor and a battery to a car, it's going to be more expensive. You cannot get around that in any way. So you have to help the consumers be able to afford those cars as well. And, you know, lowering income taxes and doing something about payroll taxes, you know, giving more of an exemption to lower-income people for payroll taxes would help there as well.
I can't help but suggest that, you know, there is a lot to be excited about in the automobile industry. electric vehicles, the whole the lithium-ion battery, concept, alternative energy fuels. I do love the micro automobile, concept. I'd love to see more Teslas, sprouting up in a variety of places. The number of, empty shells of vehicles sitting in junkyards and or, opportunities to take something that's already been manufactured and replace it with a new type of engine is fascinating. The creativity that could go into this industry is fascinating. There are designers and developers and project manufacturers. I'm an optimist, as you can tell, Sam, but I do think that it would make sense. My final question for you, because you're really in the heartbeat of the pessimistic stuff. I'm going to remain optimistic, but my question is: would consolidation of a couple of these major manufacturers make some sense to you?
Yeah, I think it would.
Maybe of all three.
Right, I mean, right now there's certainly far more manufacturing capacity than there is demand for vehicles in this country.
Right.
Plants are being closed all over the place, regardless of what happens. That's going to remain the case for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. Potentially consolidation or a gradual closing down of at least one of the manufacturers would probably be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And possibly be something that could help support the other two survivors, if you will.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah, you get rid of a third of the inventory incentive
but,
to buy.
The thing you got to remember, I mean, that's not a simple process because, there's a lot of interconnects between all the manufacturers, the domestics and the transplants, because they all use the same suppliers. So if you take away, one of the manufacturers, then there are suppliers that are also going to end up going out of business, and that's going to affect the other manufacturers. So it's
who'd
not
you like to
like you can just shut these guys down overnight.
Who would you like to see survive?
In a controlled manner.
Who would you like to see rise to the top?
Well, among the Detroit automakers right now, I think Ford and General Motors by far have the strongest current and future product lineups. Chrysler has been very reluctant to show what they've got coming in the future because I'm not sure that they have a whole lot coming. Cerberus doesn't seem to have invested a great deal of money in product development, or at least there's not much evidence of it. But I've seen what Ford has coming, and I've seen what General Motors has coming, and there's a lot of really strong products coming in the next 12 to 18 months.
Hmm. And as far as cash positions and in marketability, a lot about the marketing channels of those three companies. For example, on the show floor, the big auto show every year, who really knows how to do it? Who are the expert marketers of automobiles? And that even extends down into training of sales reps. And, who are the best marketers amongst those three?
Again, I would say, it's probably, the same two, General Motors and Ford are certainly the stronger of the three, I think. I think Chrysler is the weakest. I mean, Chrysler does have some strong points. They have high manufacturing efficiency, their vehicles tend to be put together fairly well, but, unfortunately, the materials they sometimes use are, look cheap, and, their designs of late have not been particularly enthralling to consumers. I think they certainly have the potential to succeed, but and right now in the current environment, the current economic environment, I'm not sure that they can.
Hmm. Here, one really interesting question is more practical. One of my I drive a Lincoln Navigator, a nice gas guzzler, and my local dealership closed, and a Nissan, actually a Jeep. A dealership opened up there, tell me about mechanics. So I just stupidly drove into the Jeep dealership thinking it was the, you know, Lincoln Navigator dealership because the name didn't change, just the type of cars that they sell changed. And, you know, they fixed my car and everything was fine and there was, you know, but how does this affect mechanics if one of these, you know, are there special training programs for these major automobile manufacturers, or is mechanical engineering now something that's fairly universal and the computers use to tap into the brain, the computer within a car? Are they, or is that fairly regulated in the
it's
sense that anybody can work?
Yeah, both. You know, I mean, the engine, the electronic control systems in cars now are able to detect most of what goes wrong in the vehicle. And, you know, mechanics can, or technicians, as they're more properly called now, you know, are able to tap in with diagnostic tools and read the fault codes and see what the problem is. And that, you know, that works pretty much the same now for all manufacturers. I mean, they all use the same basic processes. You know, where things get more complex is, you know, when it comes to actually doing the repair. And, you know, there, you know, with modern cars, again, you know, things are far more complex than they used to be. And so it does take quite a bit of very specialized training, you know, on specific vehicles, you know, to understand how to replace certain components. And, you know, when you start talking about hybrids, then, you know, things go up by an order of magnitude. It becomes even more complicated because you have a great deal more mechanical complexity there in a hybrid than you do in a conventional car. And again, you know, the level of training required are even more so. And, you know, one of the things that's going to happen, that's bound to happen, you know, in the coming years, you know, one of the problems that the Detroit manufacturers in particular have is they have too many dealers. You know, compared to the number of dealers that the Japanese and Korean and German brands have, they just have way too many dealers for the number of cars they sell. Unfortunately, state franchise laws, you know, basically make it almost impossible for car makers to call dealers from their network unless those dealers decide that they want to shut down. And, you know, that's one of the big problems they have. But, you know, dealers are going to have to go away. They're going to have to reduce the number of dealers. And so, you know, the technicians are going to have to, you know, I mean, you know, you're still going to need technicians to do the service. But, you know, they're going to be working in different places. I think they're going to end up working for independent shops, you know, or working for other larger dealers that sell and service more vehicles.
Mandy, any insight here?
No,
any
I'm still on the fence about the whole issue. I want to see some major changes in the auto industry. I'm sick of us stagnating. And, you know, I mean, I just feel like this is a golden opportunity here. You know, I also don't want to see all these people who've worked so hard for these pensions fall by the wayside while we're trying to, you know, figure things out. So, I don't know. I think it's a big
one. I totally agree with you. It is a golden opportunity. And, you know, the problem is, you know, that, like I say, people who haven't been involved directly in the industry are not aware with the amount of lead time it takes to develop and get a vehicle into production. You know, and the types of vehicles that you're talking about are and have been in development for the last several years, and they're coming to market over the course of the next, you know, 12 to 24 months. You know, there's a bunch of new hybrids coming. There's, electric vehicles coming. There's all kinds of vehicles coming, you know, and just generally, you know, smaller, more efficient cars. But
any
big-ass
SUVs
it's
coming?
It's not something that can happen overnight.
Any big SUVs coming that are hybrid, more hybrid? I know the Chevy Tahoe is a nice product out. But
that's probably going to be the last of the line for that type. GM pretty much, you know, they put on hold development of the next generation Tahoe and Yukon, I suspect that that vehicle will transform into a smaller, lighter vehicle. I don't think we'll ever see another generation like the current ones that we have today. Chrysler has already canceled the Durango and Aspen SUVs, and Ford, I think, has put on hold their next generation of full-size SUVs. You know, they're migrating to smaller, lighter crossover vehicles.
Is this because they're finding that they're not really as green as they could be at the end of the day, that they're still chugging a lot of gas, they're still using a lot of energy?
Yeah. I mean, basically the market for those type of vehicles that have been selling for the last 10 years has essentially dried up, and nobody really believes that it's ever going to come back.
Right.
And so they're transforming, but you know, like I said, it takes time. You know, I mean, the ones that are there now will continue to be sold for, you know, the next 3 or 4 years, and if and when they are replaced, they'll be replaced with smaller, lighter vehicles.
What are you seeing, price erosions, and even like in the high end, you know, Porsche 911s and Carreras, and you know, is it crazy on all ends of the automobile industry now?
Oh yeah, I mean, everybody is getting hammered right now. Even you know, Ferrari, for example, you know, that has traditionally, you know, been more or less immune to whatever goes on in the general economy. You know, they've consistently sold, you know, 600 cars a year worldwide, you know, for many, many years. Last month, apparently, only sold 92 cars.
Hmm.
You know, so, you know, everybody, you know, Bentley sales are down 30+% this year. Everybody's getting hammered. No one is immune.
Any stats off the top of your head on Porsche?
Yeah, Porsche was down in November, I believe, about 40%.